Hi, this is Danielle from the Jaws Curator, and this is episode 120. 120. That is kind of crazy. Well, that makes 120 episodes that have been supported by Saatchi Art. They are the world's largest curated online gallery offering original art by independent artists from around the world. You can visit their gorgeous lineup, you know where. That's right, SaatchiArt.com. So, who has seen the film Handmaid Nation? Oh, it is so good, so good. And it was followed by another documentary and book titled Sign Painters, another creative gem. Yep, today my guest is American artist, curator, filmmaker, and general creative genius, Faith Levine. I watched Handmaid Nation when it first came out. I think it was around 2009. DIY, makers, art finding its way online, all of it was about to explode, and Faith was there. Well, today she is here, and I have, oh, so many questions. I don't even know where to start, actually, because there are so many questions. Now, this is a little disclaimer. We talked for about 7 minutes before I realized that I wasn't actually recording. Oops. So, here we are. We're just going to launch right back in, talking to Faith Levine in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Okay, now it's recording. Okay, we're just going to start. So I kind of messed up and we talked for a few minutes. And anyway, we are starting again. Hi, Faith.
Hi.
Okay, so the quick recap was me gushing, saying how much I love you and that we've never actually spoken, but that you did, in fact, write a blurb for the back of my book, Creative Block, many years ago.
True.
And I was all, like, a fluster about that because, I loved Handmaid Nation. And I was all like, oh, my God, she's a really big deal. I don't think she'll even write me back. And you totally did. And then you wrote the blurb. And it was amazing. And now it's 5 years later and we're finally speaking.
Ta-da. Hello.
That's right. We'll talk again in another five. I like to spread these things out.
I mean, it goes by so fast, it'll feel like a little blip, apparently.
I know. Everything goes too fast. And so I started to ask you about being a creative kid. So you were the Girl Scout crafting.
I was a Girl Scout till later than most, until like ninth grade. And then also summer camp. And I was telling you that I'm really lucky where both my parents were super supportive of all of my creative endeavors and passions. So
are they artsy too, or they were just supportive?
They're both creative types. I don't know if I would call them artsy, but definitely like independently driven, creative, open-minded, amazing mm-hmm. humans. And but I think like a tipping point for me was I took this black and white photography class in fifth grade, like a summer program, and that was like definitely one of those moments to be noted. And from that point on, my dad was always really into taking photos. So, I mean, there was always cameras around. And photography has kind of been I'm not a super photo nerd or anything, but I do take a lot of pictures, and it's a way that I keep track of my movement and motions to keep myself sane. And
Of fifth grade, that's young.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, it's just like one of those probably once a week or something, who knows, but I have some pretty funny prints, you know, from a dark room, you know.
Yeah.
Back in the day of film and dark rooms and that kind of thing. And then my high school had a dark room in it, so I had access to the equipment, which was really amazing. So.
And so was that, once you did that course and loved it, was that sort of was photography your thing through high school, or were you still doing all sorts of stuff?
High school photography was a big part of what I was doing. I got into, I grew up in the suburbs of Seattle for my high school, junior high school years. And I had access to, the DIY punk scene. And that was a big, big part of my life. And it's sort of the foundation for my creative drive and practice at this point, as far as like my ethics go. So photography sort of segued into self-publishing zines when I found out what zines were about. And so those two things kind of like blended together and definitely can be tied into, you know, even my most recent project. So, Yeah, but then, you know, textiles and all the, you know, all the friendship bracelets and all the standards, all the kid standards that were in the mix. So,
And then so in Seattle, were you a musician or were you into that side of it?
No, I just went, saw a lot of bands play. Most of my friends were in bands or set up shows. I did a lot of flyers for shows. I have played music in my adult years. The soundtrack for Handmaid Nation, the documentary, was actually a band. This is a little fun fact, unknown fact, that was my band. So the soundtrack for Handmaid Nation was my band.
Oh, wow. What do you play?
I played, we'll say past tense. I played the musical saw, so it was like a self-taught instrument. It's not, I wasn't, I did take piano lessons as a kid.
Oh my God, that's so cool. Musical saw. That's not what I thought you were going to say. I was guessing, I was going to go ukulele.
Oh, no ukulele. Nope, no stringed instruments in my world, so.
Yeah. And so did you end up going to art school?
I graduated high school and I was on a steady path of kind of creative projects, and I had community, and I actually never went to college. So I just kind of dove right into making things happen in a lot of different ways. So,
wow. Did you stay in Seattle for that?
Well, this is where the movement starts. So I
know. See, this is the thing. This is going to get very detailed very fast.
Well, I know. There's always different trimmed down versions. I moved from Seattle to Minneapolis in 1998. So I graduated high school in 95. And so there was a couple years where I moved from the suburbs into the city. I was a member at a vegan anarchist cafe called the Black Cat, and I was doing a lot of direct action political work and organizing through that kind of community of folks, and then moved to the Midwest and eventually made my way to Milwaukee and other places, but Minneapolis was my first Midwest stop.
Okay, and then you were in Milwaukee for a long time, weren't you?
I was. I moved from Minneapolis to Milwaukee in 2001 and was in Milwaukee for about 14 years.
Wow. Okay. And so that's where you were living when Handmaid Nation happened, right?
It is. Yeah. A lot of the monumental markers in my life happened while I was living in Milwaukee. So that's when Handmaid Nation happened. That's when Sign Painters was produced and directed, and that's where I ran my gallery and had the craft fair. So
No, I know, I can tell you're trying to skim over it, and I'm like, what about that Thursday before you moved? Okay, so I don't want to skip, because I'm sure there were a zillion things before Handmaid Nation, but that's what I know about. So what led up to that, or do you feel like that was your big thing?
I mean, there was definitely a lead up point. I think I had a small, like, non-traditional gallery space in Milwaukee that I ran with my partner at the time called Flying Fish Gallery, and it was a little DIY independent gallery. I was making stuff and starting to sell it. That was kind of the early years of, like, the online craft community, and I just started kind of participating in the message boards. Went to the first Renegade Craft Fair in Chicago, came back to Milwaukee, wanted to do something similar because it was super inspiring, meeting people in person, started Art versus Craft, which was the craft fair that I coordinated for 10 years.
Such a good idea.
Yeah, and you know, and that was a big deal. And so just the DIY craft community and the energy of what was going on at that time was, you know, that's like 2002-ish, 2003. Mm-hmm. And that was really the inspiration for Handmaid Nation. I mean, you know, HGTV was doing these segments called That's Clever, and it was like about people in the DIY scene. And, you know, I just really felt passionate about wanting to capture, and this kind of goes back to the photography route, of wanting to capture the like passion and feeling and like the realness of what was happening within the DIY craft community from the perspective of someone who was immersed in it. And I just was worried that someone was going to, and I've said this, you know, a bunch of times, like, I just didn't want someone to come along and, you know, make some cheesy, hokey thing of, and that didn't really, like, get to the, like, the feeling of what the community was about. And so that was, like, my intention at the time of making that film. I mean, I feel like it resonates, or it's resonated in some ways. It's definitely a time capsule in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it totally is. It totally captures that beginning of Etsy and all of that stuff. And so had you ever done film before that?
No, I hadn't. And so Milwaukee as a community, there was a lot of folks that had moved here specifically for the film department. There was a graduate program at the UW Milwaukee. And so a lot of my friends here were filmmakers. I had access to people in the film department. And my friend at the time, Mika O'Hurley, I asked to join on and see if they wanted to make this film with me and come around and travel around the country and shoot this film that I was decided. Initially I thought I was going to just take photos and do interviews and make something like some sort of zine. And then I realized maybe there was something more there, and it just kind of turned into its own beast of a project.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like what you said about going to Renegade, like meeting these people in person is just so different,
mm-hmm.
you know, than experiencing them online or in a zine or whatever, just like seeing their actual worlds. And so how did you fund that?
I made some pretty irresponsible financial decisions, which I'm really good at doing. And so I had I had really good credit somehow. I don't know. I use my credit cards.
Funded it.
I funded it. Yeah.
Wow.
I funded it. I funded it with my credit cards. I eventually got some really amazing fellowship support through a local, the Mary Knoll Fellowship in Wisconsin, which was a really pivotal point for me as an artist. And then I did a lot of fundraising. A lot of makers donated objects, and I had an Etsy shop where I sold them online. Whether or not that actually was worth my time, I don't know, but it did generate that community. You know, it's that tipping point of a maker where it's like the amount of time listing something and shipping it, packing it, you know, it's like, wait, is this actually helpful?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm making 50 cents an hour.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was an independently funded project.
Wow, good for you. And then how did you decide, because you went all over the place, like how did you pick the people that you wanted to talk to?
Sure. Well, you know, with most of the things that I've done in my life, it was kind of an excuse to meet people that I was interested in. I mean, that's why I had a gallery. It's kind of why I had a craft fair. It kind of boils down to talking about access, which I'm pretty interested in thinking about in general. It wasn't until later that I realized that. But, you know, having an excuse to cold call or cold email or whatever to approach people. And
like a podcast?
Like a podcast, exactly. And like, or, you know, so it's these entrance points of, I could send you a fan letter, which I think is really appropriate and nice to acknowledge people's efforts that they, you know, like of what they do if you're excited about it. But it was taking it one step further. So, you know, I think I just was taking a step back, looking at people whose work I was drawn to at the time, publications that felt important to me that were contributing to the community. And you know, you brought up Etsy, and Etsy, when we started filming, wasn't a thing, and it wasn't, and intentionally didn't include the launch of Etsy in the film because I had some feeling that I didn't want to make a commercial about like a selling site, because it was unclear, even though it was really exciting and it was a really great tool. It didn't feel like a good connection, but I was, you know, we used Etsy, and Etsy was really supportive of that project at that time. And I made their first flyer for their launch party that was at Renegade in Brooklyn one year. It was all around the same time. It was tiny. There was just, you know, two guys and their idea of this project. Anyways, so I think I just trusted my gut and went with people who I wanted to meet. And We tried to schedule the shoots around craft fairs so we could shoot regional craft fairs and also do studio visits with folks at the same time.
Wow. How long did it take you to do?
Mika and I traveled for about a year and a half, and then at a certain point, like with, I think with most documentary or research work, we just had to call it. And so,
yeah.
And there was the book deal that came in the middle of that, and because they, Princeton Architectural Press, my publisher was, they had a, you know, a publishing schedule, which helped kind of keep me motivated because I realized the value of the two things coming out as close to one another as possible.
Yeah.
The book did come out before the film, but just barely, so.
Hmm. And then the same thing happened with Sign Painters, or was the book first? No.
No, it was the same. So both okay. Sign Painters and Handmade Nation, the books for both of those projects were based off of the content that were gathered for the film. They were kind of similar patterns. Both projects, the books came out right before the documentaries did, mostly because post-production for independent film can last forever. And so
right.
It was a real push to kind of finish both of those things with a schedule.
And so. What was the gap, the year gap in between those films? When did they, cause they feel to me, it felt like, whoa, she wrote, did another one, but it was probably years in between.
It wasn't, this is not my strong point.
I know I should have written it down and I didn't, but.
Well, I will get it wrong if I try to remember, but it was very lit. Well, the thing is that the programming aspect of Handmade Nation, by saying it surpassed any expectations I had is like not even accurate because it just, I traveled for a year and a half doing programming specific to that film. It was entirely unexpected. I mean, the timing of that film was so on point in the sense that people's general interest in like a larger scope about craft and DIY and handmade, turned into a much larger conversation. So anytime anyone talked about DIY craft, that was the go-to reference point. So
yeah.
I was doing all of these screenings and I started doing a lot of lectures and a lot of programming with educational institutions. So the timing of that happening, that was still going on when I started thinking about the beginnings of doing Sign Painters. And Sam and I, my co-director for Sign Painters, had been working together on commercial production and doing music videos over the course of the time before that.
Mm-hmm.
There's all this overlap, which is where it gets really confusing. So I talked to Sam about doing Sign Painters, and we did our preliminary shoot sometime, I don't know, a year and a half probably after Sign Painters came out, maybe 2 years. That's a real wild guess.
Wow. Well, and so, and in the meantime, like, did you still have your gallery going?
I had my gallery going. I was doing the craft fair. I was also a bartender. I think it's really important to talk about that because there's the reality of, like, I was actually still working a service industry job to pay to do things. I mean, you know, there's
yeah.
like this, and I think that transparency is always really important to talk about. And I was doing all this freelance work. I mean, in hindsight, I don't actually understand how it was all happening at the same time. And I don't think it was particularly healthy, but it happens. And it's really confusing to think about.
I know. That's why, like, when I was trying to figure out a timeline to ask you, I was like, I don't even know. So I'm just going to phone her and we'll just talk and kind of figure it out. And if we don't, that's cool too. Yeah, I know. See, this is why I was intimidated to call you about writing for the back of Creative Block, because I thought, when does she sleep?
I don't know. I don't think I was sleeping very much.
Sign Painters came along, were you just so jazzed out? Like, I would think that at that stage, after like traveling and the programming and everything, that you might want a nap.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, you're planning the next film.
You know, I just think that there's the pros and cons to being somewhat of a, you know, workaholic, I guess. I don't have the same work practice as I used to. I don't actually endorse it. I think it was really unhealthy, even though a lot of really incredible, amazing things came out of that time. But they're just, you know, there's always exciting things to do. So it's like that I guess I just rode this wave of energy that was there at the time.
Yeah. Well, so. You know, and it's true. Like when amazing things get presented in front of you, or you're around really cool people who are wanting to do other things, like it's, I mean, I have just started saying no to things recently, and I still don't say no to enough.
I've gotten really good at saying no, but I also just have learned to pace myself.
Yeah.
Also, just think, I just want to, like, toss out there that, like, I don't have kids, I don't have pets. I mean, like, I don't think, like, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with people who are, they're just like, I don't understand how you did it all. I don't understand how I did it all either, but also, it was, you know, I had some really understanding, like, people that I was dating during that time. Was it healthy for me or my relationships? You know, debatable, but also no kids. And that's like a really big factor. And I'm not saying people can't do a lot with kids by any means, but there is an element of like operating as an adult without children.
Yeah. You can kind of live and breathe.
Whatever. One.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I get that. Okay, so sign painters. Yep. So what inspired you to start that?
So I have all of these kind of ongoing interests and things that I keep tabs on. I've always been interested in lettering and buildings and how things, you know, in general, how things get to where they are. But when I was living in Minneapolis, I had a lot of friends who did graffiti and were also starting to hang out with a gentleman who we call Sign Painter Phil. And so Sign Painter Phil was the first actual sign painter that I ever heard of or knew or could recognize his hand as far as like his lettering styles go. And Phil Vandervaart basically dominated the look of the West Bank in Minneapolis. And so this was in the early 2000s, late 90s. And people started hanging out at his shop. And it was this real turning point for me. I was like, oh, yeah, there's a sign painter that did those signs. It's not just something that I am, like, looking at and, like, noting how the A is or the, you know, the way that, you know, I like, had the eye for it, but I didn't think about who was doing it. So that was always clocked in the back of my head somewhere. And once Handmade Nation had sort of run its course, that never had gone away. And I've always traveled a lot since I was a little kid. So just driving and looking at signs and hand-painted signs and the way the character it gives a place. And again, taking pictures of landscapes and cities and letters. So it just, and also once I started using the internet and trying to, you know, research certain things, like I'd always been interested in sign painting and sign painters, and there was very little information. I would say around the time, like, you know, between around 2012-ish still, there was very little about sign painting, which is interesting because now there's so much available, which is great for people who are interested in learning about it.
But I think that was probably started by you.
Well, I think that sign painters, the project that Sam and I did is definitely one of the reasons. I don't feel comfortable taking all the credit by any means. But you know, so I like, as someone who does research based work, filling in gaps where that research isn't there is like an ideal situation if you can work on something that provides content and access and information for people. That's ideal. So I saw a hole, and I had a starting point, which was people who I knew in my life who had been working in sign shops, who knew a lot of the master sign painters from an older generation. And so it was an in and a way to engage with that community. So Sam and I did a couple preliminary shoots and it just sort of went from there. And again, it was another open-ended sort of umbrella topic that you could just shoot forever because there's so many different facets of the sign painting community. And at a certain point, we just had to call it and stop. But
yeah, it's so cool. It's like a peek behind the curtain. It's like, and within, you know, with every little group like that, there's celebrities in there.
Yeah.
But you don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't know about Sign Painter Phil unless you pull back the curtain and have a look, and then you find out that there's this whole other culture and this history, and you know, just like Handmaid Nation, you get to like actually see that it's people creating these things. And both of those films just gave me chills. And I guess, you know, as a maker myself, like, it makes you want to go and make stuff.
I mean, and that's the best feedback that I can get and that I have gotten, is that, you know, to inspire people to make things or to be a permission giver in some way is like really awesome and ideal.
I worked at a sign painting place.
Oh,
and I was so bad at it. So bad.
What kind of sign? I won't see, this is where I want to like start asking you all the questions.
Well, it was a little tiny place in Ontario, and I was living in my parents' basement after art school, feeling like a giant loser, not knowing what to do. And there was an ad in the paper for this sign company. And so I'd never done anything, you know, but I could paint. So I went, and a lot of their lettering, they were kind of half vinyl lettering and then half painted. And then they did a lot of like murals, and they do a lot of stuff like that. Anyway, I was A, so bad at it, and B, I had such a terrible experience right before I finished university, where I was told never to paint again by my painting prof. And so I had so much insecurity. So I got into this sign painting place, and I was like scared of everything. Oof. And so, you know, they're like, oh, why don't you try, you know, doing this lettering? And I was just, all I could hear was, you should never paint again. And so I was just, I just sucked. And so I did not last there very long. I think I was there for maybe 4 months. And they were like, you know what? Maybe sign painting's not for you. Which I agreed. And but then watching your film, I was like, you just appreciate it so much more, especially if you've tried it. You know, you watch them put a letter down, and it just looks like la la la, little E, you know, and it's like perfect.
It's wild. The muscle memory and the time that people invest in doing correct lettering is,
yeah, and like the font just rolls right out of their hand as they go, and you're like, I don't even know.
I mean, I think it's a pretty common misconception that if you're a painter or if you have like some creative skill that you could just jump in, not to say this in any sort of rude way, but like you can just be an instant like letter or sign painter, and it is a whole nother skill set of everything,
yeah,
like rules, and it's a whole nother world that dove deep into.
Yeah, you did, and that's why I loved it so much, was because it is so, like, you would never think like, oh, I'd really love to see a film about sign painters. And then you, I mean, the first minute in, and you're like, I need to know all this stuff. And then so then there was the book. Was there another film after that? I feel like
nope, no other films. No.
So what year did that come out? Why didn't I write any of this down? Do you know what year that came out?
I mean, my temptation is to open up my CV. I honestly, it's kind of embarrassing. I have no idea.
It's all a blur. Let's say sometime in the last 5 years. There.
Oh, yeah, that sounds great. Sometime in the last 5 years.
Like,
for sure.
3 years ago, I want to say.
No, it was longer than that.
Oh, was it? Okay, we're going to say five. So, that's done. Do you ever want to do another film?
I mean, if someone's listening and they want to pay for it, potentially, but probably not. I mean, never say never. I don't know. I mean, no, not right now. I'm just entering into, like, a whole new chapter of my life with, like, a new job, and making a film, I don't see space for that anytime soon, but...
yeah, especially, you know how consuming it is, because you've done it twice.
Yeah, but I would consider at some point making another film, but I don't have any, like, burning desire to do it. Okay, wait, look, I'm looking right now. Sign Painters came out in 2013.
What did I say? Oh, yeah, five-ish years.
Yeah, just turned 23.
Okay, that wasn't a bad guess.
Yeah, so.
That seems crazy. I feel like I just wrote about it. Anyway.
You know, it came out late 2013, and that might have, it says, well, that's what my CV says on my website.
That's
so funny.
Go
with that.
But you have to check that. and so, okay, so that was 5 years ago. I know. I read on your website there was at some point you were living in the middle of somewhere.
I'm in the middle of Tennessee.
Yep.
Rural middle Tennessee was my last place I lived.
Okay, yep. So when was that? That was like a year ago that you moved.
That was, that was three years ago.
Okay, and why did you do that?
Milwaukee, I had hit sort of a wall in Milwaukee, and I needed some change. So it was time to figure out what was next, and I wasn't sure what that was going to look like. So I actually initially moved to Birmingham to live with a friend of mine, Marilee Chalice, who's an artist that I've known for a long time. And I kept a studio in Milwaukee, and then I eventually moved to rural middle Tennessee.
Did you know anyone there?
I did. I moved there to live with a partner. And the reason I moved to that specific area is there's a large amount of radical queer community living in a rural location. So it was kind of this really unique opportunity to live in the middle of nowhere, but still have people around in a sense.
That's what I was going to ask you, because I was like, how do you go to rural Tennessee and feel like not completely alone? So that's how.
I mean, that is one reason. I mean, I've never lived anywhere outside of a city before, so it was a pretty wild shift. I had a little farmhouse, and my closest neighbors were about a mile away. I lived alone, but there was people in the general area that I would call my neighborhood, which was like a 45-minute radius, we'll say.
And what did you think? Did you like it, or were you like, nope?
I loved it.
Did you?
I loved it, and it really served a purpose. So this kind of is connected to my intense work habits that I had created for myself, and I had hit a wall so part of leaving Milwaukee was also me making a conscious decision to make some healthy changes in my lifestyle, which I felt like I couldn't do if I was living somewhere where I had like to break patterns.
You
just like remove yourself from the place where your patterns have been established. So I was having a bunch of health problems. I was exhausted, and I decided that living in a rural location would literally force me to slow down, which it did. Mm-hmm. So that was
did it take very long for you to slow down, or did you slow down right away?
No, I had to it was like rewiring my brain. It was super, super hard. And it's still super hard. I think anyone who has, certain types of work patterns can identify, it's hard to relax. It's hard to relax yourself, to take time for yourself and to do the things that, are equally as important to getting things done. Measuring your productivity and your self-worth is a slippery slope. So,
yeah. Well, we did the same thing. I'd always lived in Toronto or Vancouver. And then 5 years ago, a lot of things happened 5 years ago. 5 years ago, we moved back to my tiny little hometown in the middle of nowhere that I grew up in. Cool. And, same thing. It was like this giant exhale, and took some time for rewiring because I'd always worked in advertising and it was go, go, go. And then all of a sudden you're like, there's nothing going. there's nowhere to go, go, go. And we'd been here for maybe a year or so, maybe just shy of a year. And I went back to Vancouver to visit my sister. And I was driving into the city. And I mean, I know that city so well. And I'm driving in, and all of a sudden, like, traffic and lights and where do you park and blah, blah, blah. And I felt my heart start to race faster again. And when I got home after the weekend, I said to my husband, I think I was exhausted for 20 years and I didn't know, because it was just my pace. Like, it was just, I worked in advertising. All my friends worked in advertising. We all rarely slept. We were constantly working or at parties or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then 20 years later, I was like, whoa, that was exhausting. But I didn't even really notice.
Oh yeah. I mean, I didn't notice until my body stopped functioning correctly, but yeah.
Yeah, I know, your body has a funny way of doing that, hey? It's just like, I said, stop.
Yeah.
And then so, but now, so I was like, oh, I've got all my Tennessee questions. But then I just saw a blog post that you put up on New Year's Eve that said you're in Wisconsin and you've taken a job at a gallery.
I'm at a museum. Yeah, I just moved back to Wisconsin in October, and I live in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and I work for the John Michael Kohler Art Center, which is one of my favorite museums in the world, and it was worth moving back for. So wow. I'm working as an assistant curator.
That's amazing. Okay, so yeah. But have you lived in Wisconsin before?
Well, I was in Milwaukee, so Milwaukee is in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sorry, but you've never, not in Sheboygan.
No, not in Sheboygan, and so Sheboygan is an hour north direct from Milwaukee.
Oh, okay, so you're not far.
I'm not, nope, but, you know, and that's why I go back to that never say never. You couldn't have, I had literally zero thoughts of wanting to move back to Wisconsin, but again, I found myself in a moment of transition and not knowing what to do, and living in the country was wonderful and beautiful, and it didn't work out. And so I've been traveling around trying to find that aha moment of where I wanted to be and what I wanted to do, and I was very directionless because I am not, and I wasn't working on any big projects, which have kept me focused over the years. And
must have felt weird.
It was very, very strange and very floaty feeling. And this job position opened up, and decided to apply, and I thought, you know, if I get offered this position, then I'm gonna take it into consideration, because I don't really know what else I'm doing. And it was a pretty long application process, and one thing led to another, and they offered me the job, and here I am back in Wisconsin. So,
oh my gosh,
yeah.
That's really exciting, though. Like, I can't wait to see what you do in that job.
Thanks. I mean, it was, the timing was perfect. The museum is incredible. I work under the senior curator. There is a woman named Karen Patterson, who I had the opportunity to meet and work with last year as an artist working with the museum as a responder to an exhibition. And the combination of meeting her and already being somewhat familiar with the museum's collection was enough to draw me back into work here and move back to Wisconsin. So I'm really, really excited to be here. That's exciting. It's an exciting time. It's my very first Monday through Friday.
And so, I mean, how are you finding that?
Well, it's, so it's been about 3 months, and I don't understand how people get anything done. It's a really, really, I mean, now I'm like kind of, it is a really bizarre adjustment of time, like prioritizing my time. I actually don't even know how to articulate it. I felt at a loss for what was happening with my days in a way. I mean, it's not like I've worked 40 out plus hours a week, you know, my entire life. That part wasn't an adjustment. It's just that it was on my own terms, you know, with my own scheduling.
Yeah, and so, it could be at 3 a.m. if that's when things are happening.
Yeah, and I'm not a morning person. It's just it's just the structure of the time and the day. And, you know, it's winter, and so the days, it's dark when I get done with work. And it's been an interesting shift. And I do a lot of things outside of the office. I'm currently working on an exhibition that involves a lot of research, so I've been in and out of town a bunch, but it's a whole new world.
Yeah, no kidding. That right there, like, not only a new job is an adjustment, but like a schedule like that is a huge adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
I always find new jobs take me at least 2 or 3 months till I feel like, okay, like, you know, until you get into a bit of a groove, but the first little bit's always really hard.
Yeah, and, you know, also it's just really interesting to note that, like, most of the things that I've worked on, unless it was my own business, like, that working freelance, there's kind of an end date, or there's, like, a final, like, end project, and so even though we're on an exhibition cycle, and I'm not always working on the same things, I'm here, I'm signed up, I'm mentally committed to being here for, you know, an unknown amount of time. So it's wild to just know, like, this is Monday through Friday indefinitely. That's a wild thought for me, but I know for most people who are probably like rolling their eyes, but I turned 40 in November. I started this job in October. It's like a lot of, you know, my first, it's a big shift. So
yeah. Oh my God. Well, happy birthday.
Hey, thanks. Yeah.
I'm 44 now and, have like realized that I'm in my 40s. That's why you're saying no now, you know.
Yeah.
There's something about 40 where you're like, nope, don't want to do that. Nope. The best thing ever. Well, and so are you still doing, so, I mean, 9 to 5, that's a commitment. And I mean, I'm sure you're putting everything into it. So are you doing anything on your own?
You know, so the last project that I did was independently published or through a friend's small press project called Bar Dykes, and it was a republishing.
Yes, that's what I was thinking of. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I did. So my friend Caroline runs a press called Pegacorn Press. And I just a real brief description of the project. When I was living in Tennessee, my friend Meryl, who is in her 70s, is this old, like deep. I'm like, what's the best way to describe Meryl? Meryl's amazing. She has been out as a lesbian since she was in high school in the 50s, and she's been politically active in so many various ways in the most righteous, incredible manner. She's a part of the Back to the Land movement, has been living in rural middle Tennessee for over 35 years, and we became really close friends when I was living there. And she's also a writer, and she has all this unpublished, incredible stuff in her archive. And so we were talking about a project that a friend of mine, Macon Reed, did called Eulogy for a Dyke Bar. And it was about the disappearance of lesbian spaces. And it was this installation, interactive experience. And Meryl's like, oh, I have this play I did, this period piece about Dyke Bar culture in the 50s. And she wrote it in the 80s, but it had never been published. And so I was like, Meryl, would you be interested in letting me republish this with like a contemporary interview with you to put it into context? So again, it's about access. And I was just like, Meryl's amazing. I want people to know about her. And also her writing is really cool and she's amazing. And so Caroline agreed to put it out on her press, and it's, we're in the second edition. Maybe it's in the third edition. I mean, it's small press, Rhizograph printed. Caroline did the design. It's beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. So that was the last thing I did, and that came out last year. I could see myself doing some other small projects like that, but probably, you know, there's always ideas. There's never like a lack of ideas, but I just try to not spread myself too thin anymore. So how that manifests itself, I'm not sure. I think I'm gonna let myself take a year. We'll see if I last a year without
doing anything. I'm just gonna say we'll see about that.
We'll see. But you know, I have some residual programming. Sam and I curated a sign painter exhibition at the Houston Center for Contemporary Craft that is closing this month. And that was a pretty exciting freelance curatorial project to do. And I have some other writing projects. I have a monograph that's coming out with Haystack Mountain School of Crafts. I was their writer in residence last year. And so I'm working on finalizing that up, and that'll come out in the spring.
I'm shaking my head right now, just so you know.
there's always the little tiny things, but that, you know, just no films or no nothing giant, no big things.
Okay, this has been documented then. January 2018, this is what you said, and then we'll just see when the next thing comes up. But I think it's like everything, the big things that you've done, it's like something presents itself and you're so creative that you jump and you go. And so, you know, I think that's what will happen. Like, you'll just be going about your 9 to 5, and then you'll meet somebody really interesting, and you'll be like, let's do that. That's what's going to happen. You can't plan it.
No, but I will say, working for an institution that is so incredible and is so fascinating is definitely satiating a lot of my, it's keeping me focused in the sense that, like, I don't know if I want to say working for a greater good, but in the sense that I am, and like working with a team for the first time on exhibition series is like, it just feels really exciting. So yeah. I'm curious for myself to see if that sort of satiates my passion for like, content. And
I bet it will to a point. Yeah. Because I know that when I worked, anytime that I've worked somewhere creative, it does. It takes up a lot of that, those creative juices, right? And it's kind of nice that you've done this in reverse because, like, I went right out of school into being a designer and advertising, and so you have no time for your own work. And then you pop out of that when you're 40, and you're like, oh, I just worked for somebody else for the last 20 years, you know? And so it's kind of cool. Like, you've sort of seen the other side of it. You know that you're capable of making whatever you want, really, you can get it done. And so it's kind of nice to put your creativity somewhere else for a little while.
Yeah, and it just presents a whole new set of challenges, which is, you know, learning other people's systems and working under the voice of a larger institution, which is really challenging and exciting to like find my agency within that.
Mm-hmm.
And especially working with such an amazing group of people. It's just like a really wild opportunity. I feel really grateful.
Well, I'm sure they're thrilled to have you in there too. You're a bit of a creative genius, not to like, you know, blow smoke anywhere, but you know, it's kind of true.
And I actually want to like dissolve into that. Thank you. I would like to graciously accept that compliment. That's really nice. Thank you.
That's why we don't have video on. That's why you're looking at a picture of my husband right now, so that you're not too mortified.
He's smiling at me with his pearly
That's
smile.
Right. So can you talk about the exhibition that you're working on now, or is it top secret?
No, I can talk about it. I'm just imagining my coworkers listening to this, me stumbling through. So the exhibition calendar for the next couple of years is pretty much, for the most part laid out, which is, really awesome to just come into, sort of an outline of programming that's been predetermined by Karen and her vision, and then kind of be allotted certain things to do within that. But when I started working at the Art Center, I began working with an artist who's based in Toronto, whose name is Iris Hausler. And Iris works with alter egos and kind of weaves fictional characters, non-fictional characters into a factual timeline as a way to sort of look at art history and some with a feminist lens in some senses with this show specifically. So Iris is introducing a new character, Florence Hazard, who was an artist who migrated to Wisconsin from France in the 30s. And so what we're able to do with this character and with Iris's work is sort of look at the history of Milwaukee specifically and what was going on there in the art community and bring that information into the exhibition. And so Iris is creating work in Florence's shoes. The work will be presented at the exhibition along with a historical timeline. So there'll be fact and fiction intricately woven together in a very intentionally confusing way for people to sort of have to comb apart. So there's been a lot of deep research about this really amazing school that was called the Layton School of Art that was in Milwaukee during that time, that was founded by a woman named Charlotte Partridge and her partner Miriam Franks. So there was a lesbian couple that founded the school, which was fascinating to me.
Wow.
They lived together. They were openly gay in the way that you only could be then, which was quietly, but it wasn't a secret. And also this project called the Milwaukee Handicraft Project, which was a part of a WPA program. So I'll reel it in. So it's an elaborate exhibition. The museum that I work at focuses on artist-built environments, and so part of this exhibition is speaking to Florence's studio and what her studio may have looked like at that time, and looking at the studio as an artist environment as its own. But it's a part of a larger exhibition series titled Unseen Forces. So Iris's exhibition is specifically focused on myth, and we have 5 galleries in the museum, so that is one of our exhibitions rotating in for the new calendar year. So.
Wow. Yeah, I think you'll be busy.
Yeah.
When does that show open?
It opens in February, so it's soon.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Wow. Yep. That is really exciting. I was just in Wisconsin.
Oh,
I have no idea I didn't even know. Like, I was like, Milwaukee? Oh, Sheboygan? I didn't know they were an hour apart. This is my Canadian geography of the United States.
Americans don't know that Milwaukee is in Wisconsin either.
Oh, okay,
so
great.
And you can use your Canadian card. That's totally great. But, but believe me, it's not. Yeah. Where were you? Why were you here?
I was at the University of Wisconsin in River Falls.
Whoa.
Right on the Minnesota border, basically, and I was doing a visiting professorship there for a week in the fall, and it was so much fun. I just the students were amazing, and the faculty was amazing, and the deep fried cheese curds were amazing.
It is one of our Wisconsin specialties.
We got a basket to share. I've told this story already on the podcast, but I don't care. I'm telling it again. We got a basket to share. They put it in the middle of all of us. We went for a faculty dinner, and it came with some sort of dip. And they're like, you need to try this because you're in Wisconsin. And I ate one, and I was like, there will be no sharing. I need this whole basket of deep-fried cheese. It was so good.
It's so good. I mean, my method of that is pretending that it doesn't exist because I think as a it's a great tourist snack, but as a day-to-day reality.
No, that would be a problem. Like, that would be I thought maybe that's why you left in the first place when you said you had health problems. It was like, oh, probably too many deep fried cheese curds. You got to get right out of that state. It's a problem.
It's
a delicious problem. But I loved it there so much. So hopefully there'll be a reason for me to come back to Wisconsin at some point because it was just the best.
It's beautiful here. You know, there's a lot of different parts of the state, and I mean, right now it's below zero, and so we're a whole other.
I think it's below zero everywhere right now.
Yeah, exactly.
My cousin's in Florida right now with her kids on vacation, and she wrote, "Florida 2018 in frost on the deck of their."
That's insane.
Yeah, she's like, "This isn't sand, people. I just scratched this in frost, so I think it's zero everywhere."
Yeah.
Anyway.
A world we live in.
I know. Yep. It's either freezing or burning. Okay, so the only thing we have left is the not-so-speedy speed round.
Okay, ready.
Okay, breakfast food or lunch food?
Oh, it's this kind of speed round. This is so hard for me.
But see, not-so-speedy speed round, so you don't have to answer it fast. This is because I am not capable of doing a speedy speed round, so it's like it's going to take another hour.
I'll take tacos either for breakfast or lunch. It just depends on the filling. There we go.
Okay, that's good. That's very accommodating of you.
I'm
a lunch girl all the way. I don't really have room for breakfast. Okay. I think I already know the answer to this. Would you rather be in front of a camera or behind it?
Oh, behind it, for sure.
How do you feel about being in front of it? Because you've done a bit of that.
I can roll with it. I mean, I've learned to... I'm better at talking in front of a camera than getting my photograph taken. But I just try and roll with things in general, but I'd definitely rather be behind the camera if I had an option.
Yeah, fair enough. What was the first vehicle you ever drove?
That was like my vehicle I'm literally the worst car person in the world. I had some sort of, like, my high school car was a hatchback of some sort that I loved and didn't know you had to change the oil, and then I ruined it.
What color was it?
Uh-oh. What color was that car? I'm going to say silver, but that could just be a straight-up lie. I don't know.
My sister had a little... My sister had a little blue hatchback that she did not realize the oil was supposed to change, and she thought that when the little oil light was on, I don't know what she thought she meant, that it was just like, you know, just showing you that there's oil in the car, and blew the whole engine.
I cracked the head of the engine. I mean, you know, that seems super reasonable. How you don't know. If you don't know, it's like I drove mine across the country, and then I didn't know you had to check the oil. No one told me.
Yeah.
I blame someone else. I don't know who that person is, but someone. It's someone else's fault.
Exactly. I agree. And then the final one, how many tattoos do you have?
I have a lot of tattoos. Uncountable.
I was looking on your Instagram feed. Is that your hand that has a tiny little rainbow on your finger?
Oh, that's adorable. Nope, that's not my hand. That's a friend's hand. I have tattoos on my fingers, but not a rainbow. Yeah.
I love that one.
Yeah, that's a good tattoo. That's my friend Kelsey's tattoo.
It's a good
one. Cute rainbow, cute girl. You have to edit that part out.
She won't want to hear that, cute rainbow, cute girl.
Yeah, now I've dug myself a hole. She can handle it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How old were you when you got your first tattoo?
I got my first tattoo when I was 17. I knew I wanted tattoos from the very first time I saw a woman with a tattoo, which was probably when I was in junior high. And my mom's friend, I remember she like was at our house, and she was like, I think she maybe I don't know who it was, so it seems fair to say this. I think maybe she was kind of tipsy, and she was like, want to see something, and like showed me her tattoo. And it was like burned in my brain. And then I had like seen a postcard of some like sideshow tattooed lady somewhere, like probably at Pike Place Market at some like magic shop, which is in Seattle anyways. And I just always knew I wanted to be covered in tattoos. And so the second I graduated from high school, I got my first tattoo. That was the rule that my mom had.
Okay.
And then it was all over, and then I just went for it. And that was, you know, in the 90s, it was less common. I definitely, now it seems like not even a big deal because everyone has tattoos. But it was, you know, I lucked out when I made pretty decent choices as a teenager.
So no, like no Tweety Birds or anything?
I mean, I don't have a Tweety Bird tattoo. I kind of wish I did, but I don't. I wish no Taz, no Tweety Bird.
Yeah, no Yosemite Sam. Nope. I never got, I always wanted one too, but obviously not with your level of commitment, because I got my nose pierced first. Mm. And after about a year and a half, I was like, I got bored and I took it out. And then I had my belly pierced for a while, and then I got bored. And I thought, you know, I am not a candidate for a tattoo.
Yeah.
Like if I get bored, that's not, like, what do I do?
I mean, I guess you could kind of like look at my larger scope of things. And when I go for it, I go pretty hard. So the tattoos are another example of that.
You've committed.
I've committed.
Yeah.
I've committed to, yeah, I signed up for it early.
And so do you just keep adding to them?
I very rarely get tattooed anymore because I don't care, and it hurts a lot. And I also just, every once in a while, there'll be like a point, there'll be something that happens where it seems like a good idea. My last tattoo, my friend Monica Canalau, who lives in Oakland, she's the one who did my finger tattoos, and that was like a friend situation, and it felt good. But it's less and less important.
Yeah.
And there's less and less space.
I was gonna say, you're running out of room.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I was so curious because on your Instagram feed, I was trying to figure out which ones were you and which ones were friends and whatever, and I couldn't piece it together, but
all very elusive.
Yeah, I love it.
Intentionally.
You're very mysterious. That's why I had so many questions to try and fill in the blanks. That was it. That was the last of my not-so-speedy speed round.
Cool.
That's it.
I passed.
You did. Good job.
Thanks. I wanted you to say that. I wanted a gold star.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, us overachievers needing our A pluses and our gold stars.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Well, I hope that I get to come to Wisconsin. I would love to see your beautiful museum and actually meet you. We've gone from emailing to speaking. Now we have to meet.
Our slow motion relationship. Now we have to meet. Well,
in 5 years.
We'll put out. Let's make an. We'll vocalize our intention of hopefully in the next 5 years being in the same place at the same time, whether it's Sheboygan or somewhere in Canada or somewhere in between.
I love it. That is a great intention. And hopefully there'll be one basket of deep fried cheese curds to share.
And also, I just thank you for everything that you've done and all the content and information that you've provided for all of us on this other side of what you do, because I really appreciate it. So thank you for that.
Well, now I'm blushing.
Perfect. The perfect place to end.
That's right. Well, you know, I always say, like, there's no way I cannot do this. Like, I couldn't stop Jaws Curator. I can't. You know, I love it so much, and I would do it forever if people keep listening.
January 2018, you're committing to doing Jaws Curator for forever. This is your marking point now.
Yeah, that's right. Till I'm like 103, baby. I'm going all the way.
Calling it out.
Fair enough. I've called you on enough things.
There you go.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this, and absolutely. Good luck with the new job. And yes, hopefully our paths will cross.
Sounds good. Thanks.
All right. I will talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye. Isn't she inspiring? I think if I'd had an extra hour with her, we still wouldn't have covered everything she's done in the last few years. There might have to be a part two. Thank you so much to Faith for taking time out of her new busy 9-to-5 life to talk to me. Thanks to Saatchi Art for supporting the episode, and huge thanks to you for listening. There will be more art for your ear next weekend. See you then.